Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Folks, every 4 years, democracy begins in Iowa.
Countdown to the Iowa caucuses. Former Democratic presidential contender Gary Hart joins me. He helped make this first contest so vital. And
we have not seen the peak of the Wuhan epidemic yet.
Fear gone viral. The global struggle to contain the coronavirus. Plus,
we're going to fail if we do not become more inclusive and we don't say enough is enough.
The first African-American chief prosecutor in St. Louis, suing her own city. Our Michelle Martin talks to Kim Gardner.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The U.S. presidential campaign has been well underway for months now, but come Monday, we will finally hear from voters. The Iowa caucus is the first election contest of 2020 and potentially the most important for the Democratic nomination. Since its emergence, Iowa has, along with New Hampshire, helped to narrow down the field. And indeed, the last four Democratic winners in Iowa, Al Gore, John Kerry, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton, all went on to win their party's nomination. Former Colorado Senator Gary Hart helped shape the Iowa caucus into the important contest that it is today. As George McGovern's campaign manager back in 1972, he saw the power of a strong showing there as a launchpad to New Hampshire and the subsequent contest. And as a presidential candidate himself in 1984, he came second there, and he mounted a serious insurgency claim against the Democrats' establishment favorite, Walter Mondale. And Gary Hart is joining me now from Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's ask, because, you know, it is to many people, really, who don't know that part of the country and who see it's a small state, mostly rural, not as diverse as the rest of much of the United States. Why is it the first best indicator of what's happening, certainly to the Democratic Party?
Well, before 72, everything focused on New Hampshire. And Senator McGovern was a dark horse candidate from South Dakota. The principal leader was Senator Ed Muskie from Maine. So New Hampshire is a lot closer to Maine than it is to South Dakota. An expert told me that there were caucuses in Iowa. No one paid any attention to them. So I said, we're going to compete in those caucuses against Senator Muskie. And in that competition, grassroots, volunteer-based, Senator McGovern came out very well and positioned himself as a credible candidate going in to New Hampshire. And thereafter, the Iowa caucuses were first in the nation instead of New Hampshire. 12 years later, I was in the same position as a candidate. And the front runner, as you mentioned, was former Vice President Mondale. And by running second ahead of very famous American John Glenn, that positioned me for a week later victory, surprise victory in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and we're seeing these amazing pictures of you back through the ages that you're now talking about. So it's really interesting. And it's quite sort of, I mean, a little quirky given Iowa. But here's the thing. For viewers, certainly our international viewers, but also many around the United States who might not know the precise difference, not just in name, but in substance of what a caucus is and a primary, can you just tell us what it is and why the caucus process is so unique and important?
In the early days in the 70s, I think the country was basically divided among the states between primaries where voters go to the polls and vote as in a normal election. And half the country were caucus states where party members got together in a neighborhood and cast their votes for their favorite candidates. And then all of those caucuses, local caucuses, were added up and candidates were ranked by how many grassroots supporters they had in these neighborhood meetings. Mm-hmm. So it's a variation on the same theme. It's bringing people out either to vote directly or to participate with their neighbors in selecting a candidate.
So Iowa is obviously very, very proud ever since you made it so front and center on the political agenda and on the political scene, very proud of its status and very proud of, you know, what it likes to say. This is where real people will make real decisions for the first time in a real important race, like for the presidency. But as you know, and as I alluded to, it's not really representative of the United States as a whole, nor of the Democratic Party. I just want to play you a soundbite from no longer candidate Julian Castro, who complained about the diversity issue. Let's just listen. It is a tweet. And he said, I was asked today in Iowa about the order of our primaries. I appreciate how seriously Iowa and New Hampshire take their role as first in the nation, but we've changed in the 50 years since order was established, and I believe it's time our primaries reflect our nation's diversity. So, of course, you know, he objects obviously to the lack of racial diversity. Iowa is 90% white, which is not reflective of the nation nor of the Democratic Party. Just address how it's changed since you first, you know, how the facts have changed, the demographics have changed since you first put it on the map.
Well, clearly, all across the country, minorities are much more visible and active, and that's a wonderful thing for our democracy. Women are now much more active than they were. Young people are participating more than they did in the old backroom days before the system opened up after 68. I think you could find a state that more approximated the demographics of the nation. One of those might be Colorado itself, that would come closer to the proper democratic profile, if you will, of the country. But I don't think the system's going to change anytime soon.
Well, since you put Iowa on the map, maybe you can start a movement for Colorado being the first one. But beyond that, let me ask you, do you think then it is still an accurate reflection of or an accurate place to winnow the field and sort of create a presumed front runner? And I guess I want to ask you in terms of Mike Bloomberg. I mean, somebody like him, yes, a late entrant into the race, is not competing either in Iowa or New Hampshire, and he's going to wait until Super Tuesday. How do you just talk to that issue? Like, he's a very important candidate in terms of money issues and all the rest of it, but he's just going to avoid them.
Well, there have been dramatic changes in American politics, as you well know, in recent decades, the introduction of social media, of small dollar contributions. Barack Obama pioneered in getting financing through small dollars, through the internet. That's another revolution. But sooner or later, candidates have to submit themselves to the voters, either in caucuses or in primaries. And there was one factor that I feel very strongly about, given my experience, and that is the first in the nation states should be small. Mm. If you started the contest with 14 Super Tuesday states or California or New York, it just means that dark horse candidates like myself with very little financing have very little chance. So I would just advocate, if it's not Iowa or New Hampshire, that it be another small state. And once again, I submit Colorado as a possible.
I know you're not an interested party at all in that. let me ask you, just to say it, why not? Who do you think is going to win the Iowa caucus for the Democrats?
Oh, I'm terrible at predicting. I don't believe the polls. I think they give you a rough estimate. But I know Iowa and New Hampshire well enough to know that days before the caucus or the primary, people still haven't made up their mind. And that's particularly true when you start with a field of 14 or 16 and it gradually narrows down to 7 or 8. That's still a lot of candidates. Mm-hmm. In my year, I think there were 4 or 5 of us, maybe 6. And that narrowed down to 2 or 3 very, very quickly after New Hampshire. So you've got a big field. You've got changing ways of campaigning from those days, which weren't too long ago. So all you have to go on are the polls, and they're not terribly reliable. Clearly, Vice President Biden is in near the top, if not at the top. But things are going to change dramatically.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, because Bernie Sanders is also very near the top, if not at the top, yeah, according to the polls. And this is the two different wings of the Democratic Party right now, the more moderate and the more progressive wings. And I want to know whether you feel the same sort of angst as many Democratic voters are telling pollsters they feel, that they just want to get the best person who can win the darn thing, you know, who can beat Trump, in their words. Let me just play for you a couple of sound bites from voters who are expressing, you know, their concerns.
I'm on Team Pete because he has the greatest chance of defeating Donald Trump in the upcoming presidential election.
I'm a registered Republican. I will vote for it, of course.
I'm crazy about it, and I'll vote.
This is no time to take a risk. We need our strongest candidate. So let's nominate the Democrat Trump fears the most. Vote Biden. Beat Trump.
So, what to your mind, given all your experience and all these years, does electability mean today? Looking at America, looking at the face of the map, looking at President Trump's base and his ability to really fire up, and the fact that he won unexpectedly last time.
Oh, it's far and away the dominant concern of Democrats. I think an awful lot of moderate Republicans and independents as well. I hate to keep going back into history, but in 1984, the issue was who could defeat Ronald Reagan. And many Democrats felt that he was about as far right as you could get. That is, until today. And it was important to people. I was a competitor throughout the nomination race because an awful lot of Democrats were looking for new leadership, younger leadership. It was a generational divide then, much more than it is now. But overwhelmingly, the issue is not what's your economic plan. It's how do you defeat Donald Trump.
Okay.
And that's going to determine who gets the nomination.
Okay, so this is really interesting because let's say there are issues that perhaps a lot of Democratic voters and a lot of people can rally around. For instance, the idea of the climate. Young people are very mobilized by it. The idea of fracking and fossil fuels. As you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have, you know, really reached out to their voters saying, we're going to ban fracking overnight. Biden has said you can't do something like that overnight. The lieutenant governor, Democrat of the swing state of Pennsylvania, says, guys, if you say you're going to, you know, ban overnight an issue as controversial as it may be, but as such a job provider overnight, you're going to have a hard time beating President Trump. So let me just play again another round of sound bites about this issue and get you to comment.
I've looked at your climate plan. Why doesn't it ban fracking?
Well, why doesn't it ban fracking? Because you can't ban fracking right now. You got to transition away from it.
Look, you're going to ban fracking all across America right now, right?
I would love to.
Yeah, I'd love to, too. I'd love to make sure we can't use any oil or gas, period, now. Now. Is it possible?
Yes.
Well, you ought to vote for somebody else.
So a climate activist confronting Joe Biden saying, let's do it now, and him explaining why. And as I said, in many of the swing states, fracking is a major issue, major issue. What would your advice be at this point on issues like this?
Well, of course, there are a string of them. It's not just fracking. It's climate change. It's trade. It's wars in various parts of the country. It's terrorism. The list goes on. Overwhelmingly, once again, the key voters are looking for someone who can defeat Donald Trump. Local issues will be important in those local primaries and caucuses. And I think there are ways in which you can address, as people are today, and even in my generation, we're addressing those local issues in which you don't alienate. It's very divisive. But you don't alienate half of a state by the position you take. Clearly, abortion, clearly gun control are so-called wedge issues that divide people. And people on one side or the other want you to definitely support their position. And sometimes that's not very easy.
And I want to just...
Or profitable.
Yeah, I want to sort of move over to the foreign policy area, too, because you spent a lot of your time heavily, heavily involved in that. So I guess just one of the big things that this administration has just done is unveiled a peace plan for the Middle East, which, you know, I mean, there are many people who think it's just an Israeli plan. And there are many people who are questioning, is this a basis for negotiations or is it a diktat? What is your view of what the administration has unveiled, given America's long-term role as a mediator there?
Well, first of all, it is a campaign document. I don't think primarily it is a serious foreign policy proposal. The Palestinians have dismissed it forthwith. Can it be imposed upon them? Of course. It's always been possible to suppress the Palestinians, for a while anyway. But that's an invitation for continued conflict for the Israelis. So the timing, the way this was presented, it's very hard to critique the proposal, first of all, without seeing it. It took 3 years to put together. I have still to see a map of that region that shows what land is being traded for what? It is overwhelmingly pro-Israel, and that, more than anything else, makes it a campaign document. But even Israelis, as we well know, and the Jewish American community are deeply divided over how to bring peace to that region. You can either negotiate it or you can impose it. This seems to me to be a plan to impose it, which will mean there will be no peace.
And I guess I want to ask you finally, since I have you here. I mean, look, your 1988 campaign was famously derailed by a personal transgression for which you apologized and faced up for and dropped out of the race. What do you miss when you look back? Do you feel that your life, your political life, has been fulfilled or unfulfilled? What do you wish you could have brought to the country as president?
Well, first of all, you've reminded half of the American people who didn't remember that experience so long ago. What happened that controversial weekend was explained by a leading journalist in The Atlantic of November 2018. It was a setup by the late Lee Atwater, whose partners were at the time Paul Manafort in jail, and Roger Stone headed to jail. And on his deathbed, he apologized for an awful lot of black mischief. He apologized to a friend of mine for setting up that weekend. But for better or worse, American journalism still hasn't caught up with that fact. You can get rid of a credible leading presidential candidate by mischief, and that's what was done.
Well, I think it's a very salutary lesson for what we're faced with today, to be very frank, given the, you know,
indeed,
dirty tricks. But I do want to know whether you regret a policy opportunity or some kind of, are there any regrets that you have? What would you have liked to have been able to do had you won the presidency?
I have only one regret, and that's trusting people who shouldn't have been trusted.
All right, Gary Hart, thank you very much indeed for joining us on really this important issue of Iowa and what it means for the presidential campaign. Thank you very much indeed. Now, Iowa is also an important state to China's president, Xi Jinping, because he visited there in his 30s as a young, up-and-coming Communist Party official, and again in 2012 as leader. Today, Xi is focused on growing health emergencies in his own country as he tries to confront that coronavirus outbreak. The illness originated, as we know, in Wuhan, central China, and it's since spread throughout the world. At least 170 people have died, and about 8,000 have been infected inside China. And those are just the confirmed cases. Fear and paranoia about the virus are rising. So with me now are CNN's chief medical correspondent, Sanjay Gupta, and James Miles, who's China editor for The Economist. Gentlemen, welcome both to the program. We're going to talk both about what it means to China and also the medical and the world at large. Sanjay, I want to turn to you first, because one thing happened today that changed the trajectory. The United States has now reported its first case of person-to-person transmission of this virus without travel to China by one of the victims. South Korea has also reported that. So here are two nations which have seen a different form of transmission. Tell me what it means, Sanjay, for this outbreak.
Yeah, and I think there are now six countries, including China, where we're seeing evidence of human-to-human transmission. The United States, as you point out, Christian, just reporting this, a couple details. The person who this was transmitted to within the United States was the spouse of someone who had traveled to China and developed symptoms, then went to the hospital and was in isolation. So it sounds like this woman transmitted the virus to her husband while she was symptomatic. Then she went to the hospital. Wow. Now he's in the hospital. I mean, look, it's concerning because we are getting more and more information about this virus. First, we thought it was solely coming from animal to human transmission. Then it became clear human to human. And now it's human to human in other countries. If you go back to 2003, Christian, in the United States, just to give some context, during the SARS outbreak at that time, there were eight patients in the United States who had been infected, but they were all travel related. There was no evidence of human to human transmission. So clearly this seems to be more transmissible, as evidenced by the fact that the human-to-human is happening elsewhere and by the numbers, which already have surpassed SARS overall.
So just before I get over to here to talk about actual, you know, China and what it's doing there, I just want to ask you, because in our setup, we heard a doctor in full surgical mask basically saying, we have not yet reached the peak of this thing, of this epidemic from Wuhan. What do you think it might look like, given the numbers now? Is it, in your medical opinion, like SARS or Zika or, you know, Ebola or those other things?
Well, this appears to be more contagious, more transmissible than SARS just by looking at the numbers. But, you know, Christian, that's obviously bad news. But think of it in the full context. OK, so first of all, there's much more awareness of this virus now and there's more testing. So by virtue of those two things, not surprised that the numbers have been going up as significantly as they have. But also, there may be many people, Christian, who either have no symptoms or very mild symptoms who may not be getting tested at all. So that increases the overall denominator, if you will, in this ratio. If the number of people who have died or become quite ill doesn't rise at that same level, that means the mortality ratio, the fatality ratio, could actually start to drop. And that's a good thing. I hope that makes sense. But, the, you know, a lot of people, if they have mild symptoms, may not be getting tested at all. And that will mean that the overall seriousness of this for most people may not be there.
Yes. And that's what people worried about in the beginning, that they could be symptomatic without showing the symptoms. Let me turn to James Miles, China editor for The Economist. Has the Chinese Communist Party, government, President Xi Jinping, have they done everything that they should be doing to tell the world what's happening, to share information, to do what they need to do in the infected parts? Well, now it's spread everywhere there.
Well, that would seem to be the case now. Right from the beginning, international experts were praising China for the way that it had been open in terms of sharing what it knew about the virus itself with the rest of the world. And that contrasts with the way that it handled the SARS epidemic in 2003, when it waited a very long time before giving these kind of details to the World Health Organization and other experts. But a lot of questions are being asked in China about whether the authorities have taken far too long to inform the public about the potential dangers of this virus spreading.
Their own public.
Particularly on the ground in Wuhan, where the epidemic appears to have broken out. They knew that this virus had been identified. They'd reported it up to the central authorities in December, but subsequently failed to inform people in Wuhan that this was happening and to take precautions. And it took quite a long time for that to happen.
And we hear sort of anecdotes, reports about certain local officials who got punished and slapped down for, you know, for trying to take this up the chain of command.
Well, interestingly, local officials in Wuhan have actually publicly taken responsibility. It's not clear exactly for what, however. And in the course of saying, in the case of the mayor of Wuhan, that he'd be prepared to resign, he's also, interestingly, fingered the central authorities, saying that he wasn't able, in fact, to release some of this information because it needed central approval first. So there's a bit of a tussle, I think, going on between central and local government.
But also very interesting about the state of political play in China and how it's changed dramatically since SARS and all those. But can I just ask you, we know that they have closed down, they've quarantined more than 60 million people, right? Wuhan, as you correctly pronounce it, we all say Wuhan, is in Hubei province.
That's correct.
And they have essentially closed it down. That's like 60 plus million people. People, what country can do that?
Well, it's a staggering number. I mean, that's like the population of Italy or South Africa. And never before have we seen an attempt on this scale to quarantine a population during an epidemic. And this is a very important part of China. Wuhan is a place where a lot of the country's car industry is located. It produces more than 4% of China's GDP. It's a major transportation hub. So this has enormous consequences, not only for the 60 million people living there who are living in very difficult circumstances right now, but also potentially for China's economy.
We'll dig down into that side of it in a moment. But I want to ask you, Sanjay, from now the medical perspective, I mean, as all this quarantining is happening, there's obviously must be somewhere a race on to create a vaccine, to try to get a vaccine. I understand China has shared or very early on the DNA of this virus, so other medical experts around the world can get a handle on it. But what do you know about, you know, how far along is a vaccine and what would that do at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of three parallel tracks that are happening. First of all, given that China did share the genome of this virus, that was quite helpful in developing the diagnostics, the testing, if you will. And that testing continues to improve so that eventually they're going to get that testing to what they call point of care. So these various places where people are being screened, they could have testing that could be done much more quickly. That's obviously very helpful in terms of mitigating the spread. The second thing, you know, during SARS, they started back in 2003, started looking at various existing antivirals, including, Christian, antivirals for the HIV/AIDS drugs as well, seeing if they had some sort of impact on the coronavirus. And those trials are underway as well. So antivirals and testing. As far as vaccine, That's a longer term trajectory. You know, typically what I'm hearing is at least 3 months to get through phase one trials. Phase one trials are to look at the safety of a vaccine. Now, they might show within those phase one trials that there's some efficacy as well, that it seems to work. And in certain situations, they may release the vaccine early if it's shown to be safe and there's some at least evidence that it works. But that's months away. And you remember with SARS, ultimately, they started making a vaccine as well, but they never ended up using it because the outbreak started to curb on its own. And with some of the public health strategies taking effect, they didn't need the vaccine. Mm-hmm. But those three things are currently underway, Christiane.
I can't really remember, but I'm sort of pulling a fact out of my head here that I think it took something like 18 months, if I'm not mistaken, for the SARS to rise and then fall. And I don't know whether I'm wrong. You can correct me. And how long do you think this will take? But let's put up this map that we have of all these countries that have now reported cases of infection. And just ask you again, from a medical perspective, quarantining this number, tens of millions of people at the epicenter in China. Russia has now said that it's closing its far eastern border with China. You know that Hong Kong has declared, I think, a travel ban to China. And it looks like, we're told, a ghost town, much of Hong Kong, because they're concerned. Yeah. Is the quarantine, I mean, it's vital, right?
Well, let me make 2 points on this. One is that, first of all, you know, James talked about the fact that there's more transparency now with regard to what we're hearing from China as compared to SARS. That's probably true. But I do want to point out that the recent data that's coming in the medical journal show that, in fact, the first patient was diagnosed on December 1st, not middle to end of December, as we first heard from the Chinese media and from the Chinese officials at that time. So it's quite a bit earlier, and days and weeks matter when you're talking about an outbreak. So weeks earlier, there was a patient that was diagnosed with an unknown virus, a novel virus. Number two, that patient had no interaction, known interaction with the animal market. So there may have already been some evidence that either that person got the virus somewhere else, or there was already evidence of human-to-human transmission. And three is that there's an incubation period. That means there's a period of time between the time someone is infected to the time that they develop symptoms. So many people have you know, left before that quarantine was in place. You know, the horses are out of the barn, so to speak, and people are developing symptoms as they get to their other countries. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that the quarantine is necessarily that effective right now. It's a risk-reward relationship. It's obviously very disruptive from a social standpoint. Is it going to have the impact that people expect? It may not. It may just, in fact, make it more likely that people within these areas that are locked down are going to spread the virus among themselves without doing a tremendous amount to mitigate the spread around the world.
Well, that is so interesting. So back to you, James. You know, Wuhan is a very important manufacturing hub, right, that whole province. And it comes at a time in 2003 when SARS was around. I think the Chinese GDP accounted for like 4% of global GDP. Now it's like 16%. I mean, it's huge. So what's getting in and out? What's working? What's not? How is it affecting on a daily basis the economy macro and the economy micro? I mean, how are people doing?
Well, you have to bear in mind that this has coincided with a huge national holiday when, of course, many people would not be working anyway, would be celebrating the holiday in their homes. But that holiday should have ended, and it's been extended for 3 more days. However, many businesses have announced extensions of it for a few more days even after that. So what we're talking about is much of the country's industry being affected by this. What will happen is that after the holiday ends, when traditionally tens of millions of people would return from the countryside to their jobs in urban areas, whether in service industries or whether in manufacturing, many of those people won't be able to return until the authorities give a green light. Not because the government is specifically saying don't come back necessarily, but simply because, you know, local officials are making it clear that traveling around is not a good idea. But anyway, factories won't be working and people won't be returning to work as normal.
And as you study this whole, I mean, it's a big global picture. China is a big part of the global economy. Is it too much to think that it might affect China's already kind of more sluggish growth, the world's growth? I mean, everybody's looking at China and worries about it. Now this on top of it economically.
Well, absolutely. And we worried enough in 2003 when, as you say, China's share of global GDP was only about 4%. It's much, much bigger now. Everyone is looking at China's economy. The Hong Kong stock market has taken a huge hit as a result of that. And that's clearly an indication that many investors are worried about the long-term impact of this. But you should recall what happened in 2003. There was a huge hit then. China's growth almost came to a halt in 2003. And I think we can expect a similar sharp slowdown this time. But there was also a very rapid rebound in 2003. Once it became clear that SARS was no longer spreading, people returned to their normal lives, of course, and businesses resumed work and, of course, really ramped things up because they wanted to make up for lost production. And the government had tools at its disposal by building infrastructure and so on that could boost economic growth. And, of course, there was a lot of pent-up consumer demand, so people were spending a lot more.
So it could almost be a weirdly kind of a stimulus.
Well, it could, although there is a difficulty this time, and that is on the infrastructure spending side. The government has done so much of it in the past decade or so, right, building railways and roads and other large projects that there really isn't much sort of spare room in that domain.
All right. And, of course, we're right in the middle of the U.S.-China trade, you know, tussle, so I wonder how it plays into that. Finally, back to you, Sanjay. As a doctor, what do you think when yet another one of these epidemics breaks out? I mean, it's just strange to think that this incredibly proficient, scientifically developed world, and China really is, still can have these outbreaks, whether it's, you know, Ebola or SARS or this or whatever it might be.
Well, you know, several things come to mind. First of all, continuous connection between animals and humans in close proximity. Most of the viruses that we've been talking about for the last several decades, really even going back further than that, have made this jump from animals to humans. And most times it's innocuous. It doesn't really cause any disease or pathology at all. Sometimes it does. There's been 7 coronaviruses that have made the jump. 2 in the past have caused problems, SARS and MERS. That's one thing that really, really strikes me. The other thing is that even without some brand new antiviral or vaccine, standard public health strategies do work. Isolating individuals as opposed to quarantining entire, you know, communities or tens of millions of people that like is happening in China now seems to work. Sort of isolating those individuals, being very diligent about tracing those contacts. Ultimately, if you look at what happened with SARS, which lasted from November 2002 before it was contained in July of 2003, and had to point to what really brought it to a halt. Some of it was just seasonal changes, as happens with viruses, the same with cold and flu. But a lot of it had to do with just smart public health strategies. As I mentioned, there wasn't a new vaccine. There wasn't new antivirals that came into play. It was tried and true public health strategies. And I think that's what's going to, you know, ultimately work here as well.
And a really important word for boosting public health and not denying them funds and resources. Sanjay Gupta, thank you very much. James Miles, thank you very much indeed. And we turn now to police violence in St. Louis, Missouri. The city was at the epicenter of the Black Lives Matter movement in the summer of 2014 after the fatal shooting of the 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson. Now, Kim Gardner, the city's first African-American chief prosecutor, is investigating police violence there. She's filed a lawsuit against the police union and the city of St. Louis itself, accusing them of, quote, racially motivated conspiracy to deny the civil rights of racial minorities. The police union and the city both deny the accusations, and Kim Gardner sat down with our Michelle Martin to explain why she's doing the lawsuit and why it's so important.
Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You decided to run as the city's top prosecutor. And I know, for example, that you called for more accountability for police officers who have been violent, who have used excessive force. You've also called for not prosecuting lower-level drug offenses. Could you just talk a little bit more about specifically what did you determine as your platform in running for this job?
Well, my platform is to look at crime as a public health crisis. We have to be about harm reduction and public safety. And that's a prosecutor who is a minister of justice. To pursue justice is not merely convictions. And in line with that is also preventing crime and preventing individuals go further into the criminal justice system. And that's my platform. So to address the root causes of fuels of hopelessness, which fuels the criminal justice system. So we have to address the economic disparities in the city because that drives individuals to the criminal justice system. That's why we look at alternatives to give people opportunities to get themselves out the crime continuum that causes mass incarceration, which we know has caused devastation and destruction to all of our communities. That's why I have looked at holding police accountable, because how we build trust with individuals in the criminal justice system or holding people accountable is you have to build trust with the community.
So when did the resistance to your policies start?
Day one when I walked into office.
How did you see that? How was it expressed to you?
Before taking office, it was expressed by conversations with the police union, who basically said that police will no longer do their job because they're afraid of the message of how we have to address accountability for our law enforcement officers. It was expressed by individuals' resistance to, one, disqualifying my office from certain cases because of certain individuals who did not like the way we were implementing reforms in the office. It was looking at how we brought in Vera Institute, a national organization, to address the pretrial and bail crisis in our communities, how we review cases, how we looked at our data and how we were really looking at who we charge, what we charge, how I implemented the policy of 100 grams or less, not bringing low-level marijuana cases and prosecuting those cases that causes more mass incarceration so we can focus on violent and serious crimes. We try more cases than any other jurisdiction. That was a big impediment that police started putting out there, that somehow we're letting drug dealers and violent individuals prey on the community. And it's this misinformation that when I took office that was put out there that somehow I don't know how to do my job.
Did anyone say this to you directly, for example? I mean, how did this communication with other folks in law enforcement take place? I mean, did anybody from the police union, did you meet with them?
Yes,
I mean, did you meet with like command officers and say, this is the new approach that we're taking and this is why it's in our best interest? Did anybody say to you directly that we don't agree with you and we're not going to do this, or was it communicated in other ways?
It was communicated by the police union representatives that the police felt like they cannot trust me as the new prosecutor because they felt like that I'm not going to go after individuals that prey on the community. I'm just going after police. And that was shortly after the Stockley case. It was a when I took office, you know, we inherited the Stockley case and we had pursued that case to trial. And at that point, there was many different officers who failed to turn over certain information, who started to not want to bring cases, making it difficult to do their jobs because they felt, per the police union, that somehow I was going to prosecute police more than prosecute individuals that commit crimes.
Could you just remind us quickly of what the Stockley case is for people who aren't familiar with it?
Jason Stockley was a police officer that shot and killed Anthony Lamar Smith, and we had a bench trial, which ultimately kicked off more protests about the way it was handled because Anthony Lamar Smith was killed by a gun that the only DNA on the gun was Officer Jason Stockley's DNA.
Would it be accurate to say you kind of feel that you walked into a hostile environment? Would that be accurate?
I feel then I walked into a hostile environment, but I felt like because of the reform efforts and the message of holding everyone accountable under the laws of the state of Missouri, I felt like somehow it was an attack on them against us. And us is the people versus some law enforcement officers, not all. And I believe that message was basically talked about and put out there by the police union, particularly Jeff Rorta.
Well, who's the head of the police union there. His technical title is sort of business manager. Let's talk about the lawsuit. It's highly unusual. In fact, some consider it to be, some think it may be the first time an elected official has used this statute, which was designed to address the Ku Klux Klan, and in some cases, the cooperation between law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan, or the infiltration of the Klan into some law enforcement entities. You've sued by name the head of the police union and a number of other individuals. Tell us about it. How did you decide that this was the course of action you needed to take?
It's not about me. It's about the people. It's about stopping the reforms that the people elected me as the prosecutor of the city of St. Louis to do in the city of St. Louis. This is the powerful few that have coordinated and colluded together to stop these efforts. And this is about the perpetuation of a system that we know has caused harm to the community. And because this is an unusual type of situation in St. Louis, we had to take the unusual measures of standing up and doing what's right. We have to make individuals uncomfortable that they cannot usurp the power of the will of the people. And that's why this suit is important.
But why a lawsuit? I mean, some might argue that this is a matter of political skill and that your failure to get buy-in from these various entities, you would know that they're entrenched interests. You'd know that they have a certain point of view and that that's what you were elected as a political figure to do, is to create a political solution to these issues. So why a lawsuit?
This is about equal justice under the laws in the city of St. Louis. This is about the people and their power and their voice being silenced by the powerful few. And the best course of action is to seek the laws of the federal courts. That's how we have history of equality in this country, is to seek that equality through the courts. Everyone deserves equality under the laws of this country as well as the state of Missouri. And it's about equality. It's no one in the city of St. Louis that will not tell you about the racial divisiveness in this city. Even the Ethical Society of Police talked about that this suit is needed and the claims in there are substantiated. And there are the Black Police Union that was formed for racial equality on the police department. This is not about everyone in St. Louis. This is about the powerful few that have colluded together to thwart the efforts of the people. Okay. And we have to do that.
You've called it a racist conspiracy to thwart the reforms that you have been elected to advance. Jeff Roeder, whom you've mentioned, the business manager for the St. Louis Police Officers Association, he's a named party in your suit, denies that this is about racism. I'm sure this is not news to you. He said, "We're not criticizing her because she's the first. We're criticizing her because she's the worst prosecutor in the United States." And then he goes on to say that the walls are closing in on this corrupt official, and she's doing what every corrupt official does. She's pushing back on those walls. He calls this, and I'm going editing a little bit here. He says, "This is the last act of a desperate woman who simply wants to silence her critics." And your response to that is?
My response to is Jeff Roeder should not have a platform to spew his racial divisiveness. He is a disgrace, fired police officer that was fired from the police department in which he came from for making a false police report. So why would we give this individual a platform to even talk about anything of credibility? Because he has none. This is an individual like that.
But he's named in your suit, so he does have the right to respond, right?
Well, that's because he represents the some men and women in the police department. That's why he's named in the suit. But he's allowed, unchecked, to say these racially divisive rhetoric that even when former and other Black prosecutors, women, came down to support myself, he told us to go back to where we come from. That rhetoric is not allowed. That's in line with this kind of rhetoric of racial divisiveness that fuels the racial divide in this city.
And the city itself is named in the lawsuit. Is that correct? Why is that?
Yes.
Why is that?
The city has, with a small few, worked to impede legal representation from my office in terms of a special investigation that we all know about that is more about the people and stopping legal representation, that everyone has a right to legal representation inside my office, as well as the elected prosecutor doing their job day to day. So that is why the city's involved. There is instances where the city is a part of bringing certain claims to start off a special prosecutor investigation, which we have some questions about. But those are facts of the case that are at issue, and that's for the lawsuit to decide.
Well, and of course, you know that the mayor, a spokesperson for the mayor, on the mayor's behalf, quote unquote, vehemently denied what it considers to be meritless allegations levied against it and expects to be fully vindicated. So I'm sure you're aware of that response as well. But I guess the question I have is that you were elected by the same people who elected these officials. And I'm just wondering how it is that you
elected, mm-hmm. but the city councilor is appointed by the mayor, and the public safety director is appointed by the mayor. So it's two people elected, the mayor and myself, but the rest of the people are appointed by the mayor. So they're in the mayor's cabinet. But let's go back to what she said. It was really a frivolous. That was the first statement, was frivolous by her spokesperson, but it was characterized as meritless. But I would say that I don't believe the ethical society of police department who supports this lawsuit, who says that there are racial divisiveness and animus within the police department and their ranks, that it's not frivolous. And so I think that the mayor needs to understand and knows about the racial divide in the city of St. Louis.
You are a part of a group of reform-minded prosecutors who've been elected in recent years. But I was wondering why it is that it was a group of African-American women prosecutors who came to support you, but there are men who share your views about the best way to approach crime. There are African-American men, there are biracial men, there are white men who share these views. And I was just curious, like, why were they not among the people who came to support you as this lawsuit was filed and as you've been under attack? I mean, doesn't, in a way, you're kind of reinforcing the idea that it's about identity and not about the ideas?
It's not. It's really the sisterhood that we have for being the first African-American female prosecutors in our respective jurisdictions. It's a sisterhood because we are under attack, different from even our other colleagues that are in the reform movies. We're not saying that they're not under attack, but the attacks are different to African-American female prosecutors. These women understand the challenges of the intersection of race and gender. When you are an African-American female prosecutor, your discretion of how you look at doing your job is challenged at every cost.
And
your
speaking
way
of
you're characterized, mm-hmm. way you're characterized, and way you are, your face is put on different caricatures is different than our male counterparts. And that is why they came to support me, because they know the attacks. The attacks are real. I mean, we are demonized. We just today, I got a letter. You know, people ask me, why am I doing this? Because it's not about me. But I got a letter which basically, and I'll read this, we are going to get you out of there. One of the other and the other. You are a low life, crooked, lying NB. Stop wasting our taxpayers. You can't do your job right. Get out in nothing but a black slut plus no brains, just air. And so
wait, that was today? You just got that today?
I just got that today. Huh. So these are why they came down, because they get the hate mail like this. They get the threats on their family. They get their children disseminated to the public so people know where their children are going to school. They get the death threats. They get the stops by police, and they're stopped for long periods of time. It is this vitriol that no one wants to talk about when it comes to African-American female prosecutors. And it is different from our male counterparts. We're not saying that they don't get attacks, but it's not the same way.
All the things you're talking about have such deep historical roots, right?
Yes, it does.
Do you feel that even if you prevail in this lawsuit, that actually achieves the cultural change that you're looking for?
The best disinfectant is light. And we have to show light on the racial injustice that's been perpetuated by the small few. And this is what this suit is about. This is about the people. The people want change. We started this conversation around this country post-Ferguson. We are the ones that started the conversation of reforming a broken criminal justice system, showing the racial divide, showing the inequities of how when you have individuals that perpetuate division in the communities, what that does. We are the ground zero for the reform efforts, but it's sad that these reform efforts are hampered in this region. And what's more disturbing is there's silence that has taken place in the city of St. Louis. There's silence in the legal community that knows the injustice, that tells me that keep fighting. It's silence inside those police departments that want change but are afraid of the powerful few who continue to silence and to impede and to discount. But this is what they're doing. They're using me as an example that if you go against the status quo, this is a modern day night ride, and we all know what that is.
Well, we know our history. But if that's the case, though, if you're saying that they don't really represent the majority of the department, if they don't really represent kind of the center of gravity of this police department, why don't they vote these people out of office, if that's the case?
But we're always talking about a small few, just like we talk about a small few who's causing the crime in our city, and we characterize our whole city by a small few, just like a small few are causing the problems in the police department. But those small few can affect the whole bunch if we do not continue to eradicate the injustice and the racial divisiveness that we know and the Ethical Society of Police have agreed that has taken place in the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. If we don't continue to have the good people stand up and fight, we're going to have the small few to impede progress, the stagnation of people wanting to come to St. Louis, to want to live, work, and play in a community that I know is great, that has great things, great people, great entities here. We have great opportunities, but we're going to fail if we do not become more inclusive and we don't say enough is enough. We see the injustice, but we have to stand up. And if I have to stand up for the people, I will. And the people asked me to fight. They didn't ask me to stand still and keep things the same. And that's why this suit is important.
Attorney Gardner, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
And that was a vital conversation about standing up for human rights locally, nationally, and globally. And finally, as many continue to mourn the death of basketball legend Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna, dads around the world are sharing photos of themselves with their own daughters. Kobe Bryant was hugely proud of being a father to four daughters and described himself as a girl dad, inspiring that very hashtag. He coached Gianna, who dreamed of one day continuing her father's legacy by playing in the women's NBA. And Kobe himself had said some female players now were good enough to join the NBA. Survived by his wife and three of their daughters, Kobe will be remembered as a loving father and champion of women in sport. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.